For the next couple of hours, we are going to be talking about healing from trauma. We have a number of really powerful guests in the studio who are very experienced with working with different communities of people working who are dealing with different types of traumatic events in their lives and in their communities as a whole. And just want to start by introducing everybody really quickly, and then we'll get into some of the issues. We are going to be taking calls during this segment, and so after we get through the first set of questions, we'll open up the phone lines, and if you've got any questions, comments, we certainly encourage you to call in, and I'm sure that you'll find that our guests have a lot to offer. So, just without further ado, I'll get right into it. I would like to introduce our guests. First, Fran Tababendung of the Wasaksen First Nation. She works at the Shawanaga First Nations Healing Center, and many of those she works with are healing from the multi-generational effects of... would like to introduce our guests. First, Fran Tababendung of the Wasaksen First Nation. She works at the Shawanaga First Nations Healing Center, and many of those she works with are healing from the multi-generational effects of the Canadian government's policies of taking First Nations children from their communities and forcing them to attend residential schools. And in these residential schools, they were subjected to physical and sexual abuse, were denied the opportunity to learn their own languages and traditions. And this is recognized everywhere, and certainly by the United Nations, for example, as a form of genocide. And she'd like to stress as well that the effects of this kind of abuse are multi-generational, so that any type of healing work that's done has to deal with the children and grandchildren and so on of survivors of this horrific experience. And Fran is currently writing up a model of healing for her community based on her work and her own experience of healing from the residential school trauma. And she's been working with a woman from the Gwich'in First Nation on Canada's west coast. Also joining us in the studio today is Michelle Millard. She's a staff person at the Canadian Centre for Victims of Torture. In her position there, she coordinates 200 volunteers as befrienders and tutors to survivors of torture, primarily working, of course, with refugees and people claiming refugee status in Canada. And they work in one-on-one relationships. The center, the Canadian Center for Victims of Torture, believes in community development and addresses the social problem and the social problems and solutions to torture in a community way. And also with us is Lucy Costa. She is a survivor of the psychiatric system herself, and she's an advocate. She used to work with the Queen Street Outreach Society, which was an excellent agency that did education work with other psych survivors, and also with social service agencies and police officers about ways to deal with mental health crises, about the rights of people in the psychiatric system. And she currently works with the Mental Health Legal and Advocacy Coalition and the Psychiatric Survivors Archives. So my name is Kristen Schwartz, and I'm a news director here at CKLN. I want to now throw it over to Audrey Huntley, who's going to be co-hosting this panel. I'm really happy to have Audrey in the studio. So could you introduce yourself, and then we can just get right into it.
Thank you, Kristen. My name's Audrey, and I'm of Anishinaabe and German descent. I just want to acknowledge that we are on First Nations territory, and I thank the Anishinaabe people for allowing us to be here. I thank our ancestors for watching over us and protecting us. Despite the genocidal efforts of the Canadian state, we are still here. I want to offer tobacco to these women and thank them for coming. Some of you have come a really long way. Fran drove 3 hours to be here with us. And I want to start with Fran. If you could talk to us a little bit about the healing model that you have developed and who you have developed this work for, and just talk to us a little bit about the work you're doing in your community.
Thank you, Audrey. I just wanted to mention that I work with a trauma facilitator who is an Aboriginal woman. She's from the Gwich'in tribe near Old Crow up in the Yukon, and she lives currently in Vancouver. And what I've been doing with my programming is I bring her in 4 times a year for 2 weeks at a time, and she works one-on-one with clients. And basically she asked me to write this model because in the Aboriginal community, this model and type of healing is validated. but in the mainstream it isn't. And that is what I'm doing when by writing the model, is to validate it in mainstream.
Great. Lucy?
Currently for money, I'm doing work with youth. But prior to that, as Kristen said, I worked at an organization called QSOS, and I'm doing volunteer work with the Mental Health Legal Advocacy Coalition and the Psychiatric Survivor Archives. All of that work that I do that I don't get paid for by the government is work to advocate and promote the rights and experience of people who've been through the psych system.
Great. And Michelle?
Well, as said before, I coordinate a volunteer program, but Canadian Center for Victims of Torture, I'm going to say CCVT because it's shorter. We provide primarily settlement and rehabilitation services to survivors of torture and war, and they do include anyone who falls under our mandate, and our mandate is generally guided by the United Nations Convention Against Torture. So we do service refugee claimants, convention refugees, landed immigrants, citizens, and we believe in a very holistic approach to settlement and rehabilitation. We see well over 1,000 clients a year, and we take care of their families as well, because our position is that it's not ever just the individual who is affected by their trauma. And settlement includes, of course, access to language, instruction, housing, other settlement services such as financial assistance, welfare. And the rehabilitation part covers art therapy, group mutual support groups. We have a very wide network of doctors and lawyers we do referrals to. Not everybody, of course, requires clinical assistance. Torture is not a mental illness. And then we have a very large group of volunteers who are involved mostly on one-on-one relationships with matches, either as befrienders or tutors. So it's complex.
Great. I think it would be good now to talk a little bit about the specific effects that the abuse has on the different client groups that you have. What are the specific effects? What are the coping mechanisms that people, in particular women, develop in dealing with the violence and the trauma that they've experienced? Do you want to start, Fran?
I just wanted to say that our focus is to help residential school survivors and the intergenerational population of survivors, which is the following generations. And I wanted to mention that the trauma facilitator states that when she works with these Aboriginal clients, that she feels she goes in there with the attitude that they've been to war because of the trauma and abuse that they've suffered in their communities. The other thing that we wanted to that I wanted to mention is that I'm finding that this physical and sexual abuse is almost 95% in the First Nations that we work with. There's approximately 8 First Nation communities in our area along the Georgian Bay. And right now there's approximately 2,000 clients that she's working with in Ontario and out west in BC and Alberta. The primary goal of the programming is the one-on-one therapy with the trauma facilitator, and the secondary goals would be the hands-on therapy, alternative therapy, drumming and singing, cultural and traditional practices. They all help in the healing process.
So how does your approach to recovery and healing, how does that differ from more conventional treatments?
Well, we focus more on the emotional pain and the spiritual part of the whole person. So basically, what she does is she uses visualization, she uses storytelling, she uses spirit validation, she uses emotional validation to help trigger body memory. And as I mentioned before, there's a whole process in memory that she triggers. And with that, there's a physical release that happens, and then there's an emotional release. And this process can go on for approximately 3 months, depending on the person, until it works itself through. So that's basically what we look at, and my job is to explain that in this paper that I'm writing, to talk about the emotional and the spiritual.
So you mentioned that the healer who's working with these women and these people has referred to it as having gone to war. So there's possibly quite a lot in common, I'm thinking, with Michelle's clients.
Well, there has been debate in the refugee protection community about the linkages between First Nations experiences as almost as internally displaced populations. It's a discourse that's happening. I've seen it happen. So it's very interesting linkages to that.
What are the specific effects of torture that people develop when they're coping with having experienced torture?
Well, everybody, I mean, it's a very individual reaction to the trauma. It depends on a person's coping capacity and the support network that's available to the person. And there seems to be also some gender differences as well. I think some of that has to do with the gender differences in how people are tortured. Men experience torture. I mean, men and women experience similar tortures, such as floggings and beatings and electroshock and beheadings and amputations and all of the horror stories you read in the news. But women tend to be more likely to be sexually tortured than men. And so you have a different level of experience, because women, you know, basically bear three burdens. They bear the burden of being tortured for maybe being politically active. They bear the burden of being tortured also because they're women. And then afterwards, they bear the burden of not being able to talk about their experiences because of safety and stigma issues. So the effects, you know, physical effects go away for the most part, especially torture techniques. Physical torture techniques are extremely sophisticated, and they're designed not to leave marks or leave long-term evidence. So they often will disappear, but it's the psychological effects that tend to be lifelong. And I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is very familiar to everybody in this room. You know, people are very nervous and they don't sleep, and they're anxious. Sorry, I'm too far away from the thing. Lots of depression and low self-esteem and concentration and memory problems, which has big implications for language acquisition, of course. And language acquisition has implications for a person's ability to settle. So if you can't learn the language, you're not going to settle and integrate very well. You're not going to feel like you belong to a community. You're more likely to isolate yourself, and then, of course, you don't participate. So it becomes this ever-widening cycle of isolation and loneliness. Defense mechanisms that are developed as life-saving devices during the trauma are often perpetuated in safer situations, and they become inappropriate behavior. So you have people who are very suspicious and paranoid and hyper alert and triggers. And you want to?
I just wanted to say within the Aboriginal population that we're finding that there's just as many male victims. It's just that they don't come forward. Mm-hmm. It's harder for them to talk about it. Whereas we have more women that participate, but the numbers are just as high as for men. And also, we feel that pain, the trauma and abuse that they've gone through, it stays in the body until they work on those issues. Mm-hmm. It manifests, and if they don't deal with those emotional issues, then it'll manifest into an illness. And there's a high prevalence of cancer, diabetes, and heart disease within the First Nation population. And we know that there's a relation between that and the trauma and abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we also acknowledge that linkage between the physical and psychological. A person having a headache, is that physical or somatic? A person experiencing a person experiencing backache, is that a result of the beatings or is that stress? Or, you know, it's you're right, you're absolutely right. Being able to deal with their experiences is very paramount. But again, it depends on how you deal with the experience.
So if we could hear from Lucy, I'm wondering if you're hearing any commonalities, anything that reminds you of your work.
Well, actually, as I'm sitting here and listening to Fran and Michelle, I'm thinking, oh, this is funny because here in the West, the system that is sort of mainstream for helping people, which is psychology, psychiatry, I'm thinking about all the people I know in the community that I know that actually experiences psychiatry as abusive and torturous, which is interesting as I'm kind of working through those thoughts. I identify as a psychiatric survivor, which is my identity politics, and it's a specific kind of politics. Not everybody identifies differently depending on what their experience or contact is with the psych system. I just kind of have to go through this just to clarify a little bit. Some people feel that they have been helped by the psychiatric system and want to continue to be helped and work within the psychiatric system. And that's what they see their role as, and perhaps they don't even have a sense of politics, while others have a strong sense of politics and may even be as extreme as having feelings of wanting to completely abolish this so-called system of help, because in fact they feel that it's not helpful at all. Some of the complaints from people who've experienced the system badly have to do with things such as ECT treatment, electroshock, quote-unquote therapy, being restrained in 2 or 4 point restraint, which means your arms and your legs are restrained for anywhere from 15 to minutes to an hour or more. And so the questions for me around this issue of trauma, abuse, healing are, what do you do with people who are trying to get help, who've been in systems of help and in fact have been re-traumatized by those very systems?
I'm just trying to think of how to phrase a question for you, Lucy. You're working with people who, by and large, have experienced some kind of trauma in their lives and then go to the system for help and are mm-hmm. sort of don't
always get the help that they want.
Right.
Some people do. Generally, okay, if we take, let's say, women's experience, if you have contact with the psych system, okay, if people are exhibiting strange behavior, odd behavior, crisis behavior, generally we tend to look at it from one of two lenses. The first and the most predominant one would be the medical model lens, where you see the strange behavior, odd behavior, crisis behavior, whatever, situated in biology. And then based on that assumption or starting place, there'll be a series of events that follows, i.e., for example, if you have contact with the psych system, you'll then be asked a series of questions to determine what your diagnosis is or your label. Once you have your diagnosis or your label, then you can determine what the treatment is. And more often than not, guaranteed in the psychiatric system, it'll be medications. So that's one perspective. The other perspective is an alternative perspective, which I'm more interested in, which is how to not so much focus on biology or the body, but on social analysis. So if you have a woman who's experiencing depression, do we focus on the fact that we want to call that depression and treat that with Prozac or Seraphim or whatever? Or do we want to look at the, would we want to apply an analysis to what's going on in this woman's life, what has gone on, and get her to a place where she's living the kind of life that she wants to live? It's a much more different approach where the person who has power is, it's the person who is putting the power in the hands or life of the person who's involved, as opposed to putting the answer with an expert, if that makes sense, what I just said.
What kind of tools do you use or have you seen being used that will help people who want to sort of pursue that different way of dealing with their issues, whatever they are? Like what types of tools do you see being effective?
Well, when somebody is in a place of crisis, I think there are assumptions that that person's in crisis 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is not true. Generally, people get into a state of crisis because things have happened.
And sometimes multiple things happen. So they have loss, maybe lost a family member, maybe lost a job, maybe they're poor, maybe they don't have a place to live. And when those things start to build up, people generally respond with crisis. Now, again, some may, if you have contact with the psych system, that will get diagnosed. But in an alternative, what you want to do is get that person to a place of stability again, where you get them back to a place of safety and include them in a process of figuring out what they need for them. Now, generally, what we need for that to happen is an environment where that can happen and where you allow people to maybe have a crisis, maybe be angry, maybe be psychotic and not focus on the fact that you want to call it psychoses. Unfortunately, our current government doesn't fund alternatives to the psychiatric model or the medical model perspective. So there are a few like places, maybe one or two in Toronto where you can actually go if you're in crisis, but generally it's hard to get into those places because they have a waiting list. It's, you know, hard to even get through the phone line sometimes. And I think that's what we need to lobby our government for, is to give more money to alternatives, because there's a lot of initiatives happening.
Fran?
Yes, I just wanted to mention as well that with the work that Rosalie and I do, that it's a holistic model, and like I said, we focus on the emotional, which in turn enhances the spiritual, the mental, and the physical part of the person. And what we're finding is that it impacts on people right to their cellular level. So there's actual changes in their cells.
Maybe we can just talk about that for a few moments. I'd like to know whether either Lucy or Michelle would like to make any comment about the relationship that they see between the emotional, psychological, and the physical, and how people can promote, you know, health for themselves or with other people that they care about. Is there anything that you could add to just how you see those things connected?
So a lot of it has to do with the person's own feeling of empowerment, whether they feel that they have the right to take charge of their own healing. There's a lot of things against it for women, and particularly for women in traditional cultures, because all of that person's experience is about not thinking about yourself, right? You take care of your family, you take care of others, but you and that's who you are. That's what your identity is. And even dealing with extreme trauma and, you know, the really ugly things that can happen to somebody, often the woman never, she doesn't really address her own issues, at least right away. The priority is trying to get the family through. And then there's what do they disclose? You know, we find that our clients in their support groups are more comfortable talking about the physical violence that has occurred, because that is something that is shared by the men as well. Everyone has the same experience. But they don't talk about the sexual violence, not even in same-sex groups. You know, it's just something that they don't do. And part of that, obviously, is the whole traditional culture, but also there are cultures that don't talk about their problems. You know, they find other ways to deal with it. So mutual support groups are really important, but we also have to be very careful that we don't impose our you know, Western ways of doing things. We tend to think that, you know, if you talk about things, you shall be free, which works. You know, it does work, but it doesn't always work. And sometimes it can cause more harm than good, because the person has to be ready to talk. And a whole lot of things, I think, have to be in place before that happens. And with refugees or refugee claimants, you know, for us, in our experience, you have to address the immediate needs first, which is housing and food and education and status. You know, status is such a big thing. Nothing ever gets dealt with until status is dealt with. So we tend to branch out in different venues, and we make linkages to very different people and organizations to help address those needs. And only after a long period of time, I find, is our client We use the word client. I know it's kind of awkward. Only after a long period of time do our clients really come to the point where there's a recognition that there is an I. You know, they can talk about themselves as an I rather than all of us or we or part of a group. And certainly one of our counselors, or actually probably all of our counselors in the groups, work very hard at creating that sense of I.
How do people find you?
Mostly it's through referrals, through doctors or immigration lawyers, refugee lawyers, teachers, social workers, healthcare professionals. Sometimes we get people who know about us somehow and they walk in. Clients bring their families as well and friends.
We are speaking with Fran Tababandong, Michelle Millard, and Lucy Kosva. And we're going to take a quick break now and come back. We're going to open up the phone lines for a little while. If people have any questions for these guests, please feel free to call 416-595-1655. And we will be back in just a moment. You're listening to CKLN.
Be whole, the prophecy. dig in the ashes, find the love. We can go to that place where our names and lays that we must behold.
My name is Debbie Young, and I would just like to celebrate with all of us for this International Women's Day. Come make we look upon this situation, this feminism 101 where we elaborate on Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem cannot have room for I. It forces the exclusion, not the black woman, black bush woman, not the black woman, black bush woman. My lips are liquor thicker, my ass are liquor higher, my nose are liquor broader, my skin are liquor darker, makes me an outsider. Me. An outsider. Darkness is the embrace of the absence of light, the beginning. Darkness is a black womb where we all come from, black woman. Ain't I a woman?